What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
I'm fine. If there's nothing in the end.
Are you?
Maybe I was programmed this way as well.
That's from After Yang, a meditative new science fiction film about grief and loss that is also one of the best films of the year so far. This week, we've got an interview with the film's director, Koga Nada, plus thoughts on the movie from Next Picture Show hosts Tasha Robinson, Scott Tobias, Genevieve Kosky, and Keith Phipps. That and more ahead on Film Spotting. Welcome to Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar. Josh is off this week. He is hosting Ebert Interruptus at the Conference on World Affairs in Boulder. As I record this, he's on day three of watching Steven Spielberg's Jaws frame by frame. Lucky guy. I'm a lucky guy as well. This week, I've got a conversation with director Koga Nada. He made one of the best films of 2017, Columbus, our winner of the Film Spotting Golden Brick Award. And now he's followed that up with one of the best films of 2022, After Yang, a distinctive imagining of the near future complicated by technosapiens, clones, and something called tea crystals. Josh and I reviewed After Yang very favorably a couple of weeks ago. This week, we're going to share another review of the film from the critics on our sister podcast, The Next Picture Show. Host Scott Tobias, Tasha Robinson, Genevieve Kosky, and Keith Phipps are all great critics, so they had some really insightful things to say about the film, but they also each had very personal responses to the film. That review later in the show. Also later, Film Spotting Madness, Best of the 70s. I'll share final four results and our championship matchup. Spoiler, Josh is spending all week watching one of those championship contenders. Before all of that, my conversation with director Koga Nada.
What are you doing? Come on. What happened to Yang?
I don't know. He shut down last night. He won't restart.
Has this happened before?
No.
If we can't get Yang fixed, we're not gonna buy another sibling for Mika.
It is an interior core problem. I need your permission to break open the core.
I want to start by going back to January 2020. Josh and I were, of course, blissfully unaware of the pending pandemic, and we did our top five questions about the movie year, our 2020 movie preview. Josh's number five question was, with After Yang, will Koga Nada be the latest Golden Brick winner to go on and achieve even greater things? Oh, man. So we've been anticipating, highly anticipating your film for 2 years. Wow. And if Wikipedia is to be believed, you started production in May 2019.
Yeah.
So what's it been like finally getting your film in front of audiences?
I mean, yeah, it's been like a relief. Yeah, I think there was a real moment, you know, where I just wanted it to be out in the world and, you know, to be discovered in whatever way possible. So, yeah, there's a great deal of satisfaction that people are able to engage it in whatever way, you know, possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. When we reviewed the film on the show a month or so ago, I referenced a recent New Yorker profile about the filmmaker Celine Sciamma in my intro.
Oh, God, yeah.
The piece discusses her approach to storytelling and how uninterested she is in exploring traditional dramatic conflict. And I read it a day or two before seeing your film. Mm. I couldn't help but connect her approach and yours. I was rewatching Columbus just a few nights ago with my daughter Sophie, and there's a scene where Casey and Jen wake up in the room Jen is staying in. He's in the chair, she's in bed, and Eleanor knocks on the door, and then Casey has to leave in a scramble and she's kind of sneaking out. And I immediately started thinking, even though I'd seen the movie before, oh no, this is going to lead to some kind of misunderstanding with Eleanor or with someone she runs into, and it will create tension between the characters and some kind of obstacle to overcome. I think we're just wired that way.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, that's not what happens at all. The tension volume, let's call it, gets raised, I think, even less in after Yang. And there are lots of possibilities for misunderstandings or for competing desires and motivations that just that don't occur, which doesn't mean that the narrative doesn't have stakes or the characters are experiencing anything less profound. And for Siyama, according to this article, the approach was an evolution. It was a conscious artistic choice. How conscious are you of wanting to tell those kind of quieter stories?
Yeah. Well, I love her films and filmmaking. That's, it's certainly conscious, you know, and even playing with the expectation, like introducing the possibility of that sort of conventional tension and then maybe alighting it. I mean, I, there are filmmakers who've done that. Ozu classically, you know, always sets up like, oh, this is, this sort of drama. And then he's almost after the fact, you know, they've elided the whole thing and now they're just sort of talking about it. And I know, I mean, beyond the trickery of that or whatever that might be, and I don't see it as a gimmick, you know, I just know that when those moments happen, I am a little bit more interested in the in-between moments or the moments after. I remember with Columbus, like the most dramatic part of that story in my mind happened 2 years before Columbus, and I never had any desire to show a flashback of the drama of it. You know, it was really the aftermath and how people are dealing with it. And there's something about that element that's a lot more interesting to me. But you're right. You know, it's not the classic way that drama is presented. But I would also say there's a real tradition of that in so much of cinema, maybe not American film, you know, making, but I think around the world, you know, a lot of films aren't driven by those kind of sort of classic stakes and tension. And certainly here too, I knew when I was introducing them, there was that possibility, but I was more interested in the other elements of that.
I want to follow up on that notion of alighting, because I was reminded watching Columbus that near the end of that film, there are some revelations of sorts in terms of what Casey is going on to do next. And those things aren't addressed in a conventional way in terms of really making sure the script has set those up. I wasn't surprised by those moments at all because of the ways you did at various points throughout the film allow us to understand that that might be the reality, but you didn't make it explicitly so. And I guess I'm curious if that was a decision you had already made in the script writing or if it was something you kind of figured out in the editing.
No, I think that was always in the script. I mean, all the way through filmmaking, you know, you're constantly, it's this constant battle of decisions, and every decision is some value judgment of what you value as a filmmaker, you know, and there are thousands of them, and they happen either in post or while you're writing or certainly on the set. And I do think, you know, for me, like, the value of wrapping things up or setting it up and then giving everyone the sort of like, oh, here's the answer, you know, I just don't value that much. You know, it's not as interesting to me to tie everything up and to make sure that we all know exactly what everything means or why everything happened, because I don't know, you know, honestly, as a writer too, I love to keep a story and characters a bit of a mystery. You know, I don't want to take like a godlike stance where I'm like, oh, this is exactly why everything happened and every, you know, so it's like, I think to keep the process of filmmaking engaging to me, even as I'm doing it, you know, it is the things that I don't know that are most interesting to me. And I do value that openness. You know, I know that will stay with me longer when there's still quite a bit I don't know about it, you know, and the characters and all of that. I think the biggest compliment for me would be for a film to stay with someone and even almost unexpectedly, you know, to be impressed. And then a week later or months later for you to still think about this film that maybe didn't impress you in the moment, you know, because so many of the films that have really had such an effect on me was sort of like that, you know, that I was still engaging it somehow. And a lot of those films are open. And it's not as if I've figured that out or the formula of it. I just, as you're kind of making a film, you just keep making decisions that you value and you keep trying to make the film that you want to see, you know?
Yeah. Well, in terms of those mysteries, there's that great moment in After Yang, and I apologize if I don't get it exactly right, but Yang is talking to Kira. It's a flashback. And I think he says something along the lines of, do you want me to be honest with you? And she says, is that even an option? And we as viewers are thinking that in that exact moment too. And it must have been kind of freeing at some point to say, it's okay that I don't have to establish all the rules of this universe.
Yeah.
Was that how you approached it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, that was like, it was always surprising to me with Yang's dialogue because I didn't think that I didn't want to know how Yang completely worked. I didn't want to feel like I was his programmer. And so there would be these statements that I, you know, in these dialogues that genuinely I would write and be curious about, you know, and, and I would be surprised, you know, for him to say, can I be honest? You know, I remember writing that and then immediately thinking, well, wait, have you not been honest? You know, I had that exact sort of like, if I'm going to have this conversation with this being that I was increasingly fascinated with, yeah, how would that go? And there was a real pleasure in that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think it would have been so dissatisfying for me, again, personally, subjectively as a writer, to kind of feel like, oh, I know exactly how Yang works and why he's saying what he's saying and all of that. Because so much of the film itself was about peeling the layers of Yang and figuring out what his value was and you know, what it meant for Jake and his own search for meaning,
So earlier I used quieter in the sense of a reduction in conflict, but your films are actually very quiet. So much so that when Casey turns on the radio or turns it up really loud in one scene near the end of Columbus, it's extra jarring, actually.
Yeah.
And after Yang, characters almost seem to communicate in whispers. And it does offer, for me, a viewing experience that is quite peaceful and quite serene. I'm curious, is the production as quiet as what we see reflected on screen?
I mean, I feel so fortunate because, you know, there has been, you know, I've had two films now and it you know, says a lot about the actors and the DP and all the department heads, because I think the team has, you know, there's been a quality to both of those sets that have been really lovely and yeah, I think fairly peaceful, you know, and I think, you know, both John Cho and Colin Farrell and all of the actors, you know, certainly Haley Richardson, they all have a certain, you know, sensitivity, decency, kind of, there's a generosity about them. And I think that, yeah, there isn't a ton of chaos or tension in it. And I think, you know, I don't like give them the instruction to be quiet or to do it quietly. There are some, you know, I do write a script now. I'll write silence and there are some cues. And I think that through conversation and through, you know, that's what they sort of walk in to. Yeah. So it's been surprising because there's certainly in the dialogue, you know, it's not something that we are constantly talking about or like, hey, let's be a little bit more hushed. I think these actors just sort of bring that into the scenes. And I think maybe it's through conversation, maybe it's through kind of getting a sense of how this film is going to work. It has just sort of naturally been that way. And because we don't always do a ton of coverage and because there's space for them to do the scene, yeah, I think it just gives them some time. You know, like I don't think they feel like they have to pace it a certain way, you know.
What do you like about tea?
Do you mean the taste of tea?
Maybe. Is the taste why you like tea?
Has something to do with it?
Is it why you've given your life to tea?
Given my life to tea? Well, that sounds pretty serious.
Is it not serious?
I guess I've acquired a taste for tea. But it's not why I became interested.
You mentioned the sensitivity. That certainly comes through in all the performances. But you, with an actor like Colin Farrell, I don't want to suggest that by saying he's so restrained here, maybe the most restrained I've ever seen him on screen, that he's always appearing in films and chewing scenery, though, of course, he's capable of lots of things as an actor. Yeah. He has a wide range. But I'm still wondering how you worked with him or how he came to the project approaching the character and was able to tap into that kind of serene thoughtfulness that character has.
Yeah. I mean, Colin, you know, as you know, as a lover of films, you know, he has always had some deep interiority in his, I think, in his acting and even, you know, he's been in the loudest films. He's been in giant franchise blockbuster films, but I've always seen as someone incredibly soulful. You know, like there is a, and you meet him and you realize, oh, that is who he is too. You know, that he has layers within him. He's, you know, incredibly thoughtful and reflective and poetic, and there's just, it's just, and it's all genuine. So he, you know, when I found out that he was interested, you know, it was just, I, you know, it was overwhelming, because, you know, he is such, for me, just not only a high caliber star, but a high caliber actor. And then you meet him and you're like, oh, he's a high caliber human being. And so, yeah, of course I was just thrilled, and we had conversations about it, and he certainly got it. You know, he just got it, understood it. I think he found a range that was already his, and knowing that he was going to play the notes a certain way. And then even in the day, you know, on the day, if another actor brought a certain kind of energy, he was also very, like, you could tell he was just so attuned to the moment that he would adjust accordingly. And he would never, you know, it was really amazing to see, because, you know, I think, you know, he was certainly the lead, but God, there were moments where he could feel like some other energy from the actor, and he would compliment, you know, he would never try to overtake that, but it was very true to the character as well. So yeah, it was really something.
Before rewatching Columbus a few nights ago, I hadn't seen it since we last talked, and I didn't have it very fresh in my mind necessarily then when watching After Yang. I was definitely struck by a couple other similarities beyond what we've maybe touched on. Most obviously, I forgot how much Columbus 2 is about characters dealing with grief.
Yeah.
You know, Casey and Jen are each processing loss in different ways, just as Jake and Kira are, and all four characters are dealing with an atypical type of loss.
Yeah.
And Jen also spends a fair amount of time walking around his father's room and investigating the space.
Yeah.
And interacting with different objects, just as Jake does when trying to understand who Yang really was. I feel like they're kindred spirits. They're on similar missions here, almost like detectives. Were you aware of
these
connections at all?
No. And, you know, and you even bringing that up is also like a revelation. But someone mentioned something similar at a Q&A. And yeah, it was so surprising because, yeah, I had never seen that connection. And now when you talk about the room, they didn't bring that up. And I'm like, God, that's exactly right. And one of the things I was realizing, because I've said this in some interviews, that when I read the short story, it was about this sort of catching up to grief. Like, you know, Jake isn't immediately grieving the loss of Yang. And I thought, oh, that, you know, that's such an interesting idea of grief. And now that I think about it, you know, Columbus is also Jen catching up to grief, you know, that he's not immediately sad that his father might be dying. So I don't know what that is, you know, but I thought it was new with After Yang, but I'm like, even as you're talking about it, it's like, oh no, that is the experience that Jen is also having, is that he's sort of catching up to it. And there is something there about, you know, the, whatever that means, you know, it's interesting to me, because grief itself requires, like, the feeling of loss and the feeling of absence really requires like a feeling of presence and love. And maybe, you know, I think about it in my own life and I think, oh, I know that there have been real times where I have felt very detached and disconnected. And there's a comfort to that because you don't feel vulnerable, you know, and
absolutely. Then, you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, being a father and all of that has really exposed. I mean, I certainly was writing this in the midst of fatherhood. I mean, we talked 5 years ago, you know, my kids were like in elementary school, and you have kids, right, as well. And
I have kids, and I've recently taken on two foster children. So I'm back to having, I have a 2-year-old and a 2-month-old at home at
Amazing.
The moment.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
So,
congratulations.
So, yeah, definitely connecting with different material in new ways, or revisiting
That's
some
right.
of those thoughts and concerns.
Yeah. And so, I mean, God, that's congrats. That's a houseful. Are all your kids still at home?
I have one who's in college.
Okay. Wow.
Otherwise, the others are here. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one day maybe I need to get some advice from you as my kids are going through their teenage years.
Yeah.
But it's, so, you know, the vulnerability, the sudden vulnerability, and what the exchange for that, like, Yeah, the cost of loving something or someone or even your pet and all of that. Yeah, I mean, I'm still processing. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is that I'm pursuing there, but there is something, you know, that's very interesting and engaging to me.
It's the artistic endeavor, right? It just it's your fingerprint, whether you're conscious of it or not, right? Some of those motifs and themes are going to emerge and reemerge. I swear this happened when I was watching After Yang, probably because I knew there was a strong chance that I was going to talk to you again. At one point, I wrote in my notes, was there a scene or what was the scene or moment or idea or line? And it could be when you were writing it or envisioning it or when reading the source material that sparked the idea, I have to make this. And maybe that didn't happen or doesn't always happen. But I was curious if there was a moment like that. And just as I finished writing that note, we get to the scene where Yang and Jake talk about tea. Mm. They have that long flashback conversation. And Jake talks about the Les Blank documentary, All in This Tea, which I did watch after seeing After Yang. And he's got that great Herzog line, and we even get Farrell's Herzogian delivery of it. And it seemed to me as potentially as likely an explanation or an inspiration as anything else. Exploring that idea, unpacking that idea that Herzog delivers in only the way he can. Was that in the source material, or was that something you brought to it?
Yeah. No, I brought that to it. You know,
did it affect you as significantly as it did Jake, or was it unique to him? The character?
No, that documentary?
Yeah, in that moment.
No, I mean, that documentary, I remember watching it and feeling, you know, and sometimes when I watch someone who finds so much meaning in what they're pursuing, and often it's a craft, and I feel this way with architects too, when they're talking about their buildings and kind of, and they really believe in what they're pursuing, you know, and they talk about space and why it matters. And I find myself, you know, as a modernist who wants to find a sense of meaning in the world, you know, it's in that realm of art and craft that I can often long for something, you know, this real longing. And yeah, and when I saw that documentary, you know, it was this person in such pursuit and belief that tea mattered, and that a certain kind of tea mattered, and a certain way of tea mattered. I remember being so moved by it, you know, and so it was like this foundation for building Jake myself, because I think in the story, you know, he's not a tea maker or anything, but I was trying to think about the father and this sort of point where the story opens, and you get a sense that this thing that once was a passion has he's lost it, you know, been a little bit I'm interested in this sort of feeling of being disillusioned, you know, whether it's whatever kind of belief it might be. And whether what it takes to rekindle that, you know, and what it takes to overcome it or reject, you know, I've gone through that, I think, many times in my life where I feel like, oh God, this is so meaningful, and then it becomes something else. And you know, film is the most obvious example, because I think most of us sparked to film, loved film. It was suddenly becomes a passion. It becomes your identity. And then, if you're hosting a podcast, if you're making films, you're a critic. You know, there's this inevitable moment where it might lose this thing that was initially more than occupation, more than, you know, career. So yeah, so all of that, as I was building out Jake a little bit, that element, and then that documentary was just came to mind as kind of his, that moment for him that felt very meaningful and kind of sparked his own pursuit and, you know, and this career. Yeah.
There's this part in the film, it's a great part, where the man is explaining to his German friend why it's so difficult for him to describe the taste of tea. He says there's no language for it. You know, there are no words to adequately express the mysterious nature of tea. And his German friend, who's just standing right beside him with a cup of tea, says, yes, but I imagine things like you are walking through a forest and there are leaves on the ground and it just had rained and the rain has stopped and it's damp and you walk And somehow, that is all in this tea.
I'm sure you've been asked about it a lot, and I'm going to add to the chorus here. That opening credit sequence, the dance scene, the game show, if you will, that's occurring across the country, it seems, or could be. That's one of the mysteries we can try to think about as we watch it. But it isn't until, at least for me, the second time you see it, that you really realize you can't know the first time you're watching the film necessarily that you're never going to meet some of those characters who you're seeing.
Yeah.
Or that even you're about to see some of these characters. You may not remember them from that dance sequence, but this idea of unifying all of these characters in this moment together, there was something for me moving about it, in addition to just how kind of exuberant and fun it was. Yeah. And I'd love to know how much work it was and what the work was in terms of conceptualizing that and actually filming it.
Yeah. No, I sort of loved that when I was writing it. You know, I wrote this line where she's like, oh, I just want to be a family, a team. And again, if you're married and you're raising kids, you know, that you have those conversations with yours, but, you know, like, because, you know, it's the real challenge of like getting everyone scheduled together and working together. And and that, so those lines were familiar. And then I just immediately thought of a straight cut to like the families literally kind of being in sync and being a team. And then just the thought of it was really delightful. And it just felt like what a great way to kind of introduce these characters within the context of family, and knowing that not everybody's family would show up, but that we are all from families. You know, the one thing that is universal about all of us, whether they're broken families or not, that we are a part of some sort of family makeup. And so that once that conceived that, then we got this incredible choreographer who, she's also a filmmaker, Celia Rowson Hall, who did the choreography for it. And it was really tough because, you know, she would have loved to have a week or two to really get everyone in sync, but she had literally about 2 days for us to kind of get everyone on the same page. And we dedicated pretty much a day, maybe just a half day to it. And I had this idea, you know, I had seen this Shaw Brothers martial arts film when I was like maybe 9 or 10. It was called The Kid with the Golden Arm. And there was this sort of opening credit sequence of these different martial art gang members doing their specialty dance. And they had these sort of silvery kind of outfits, you know, and it was like a color background. I pulled that up. I found it and I was like, oh, this is kind of the visual presentation. I just wanted to be very minimalist, but have these color blocks. And
Welcome, families of force, to our monthly dance-off. We have over 30,000 families competing tonight. Are you ready? Stay in sync.
Another aspect of the film I love was the way you approach showing us glimpses of what this future world actually is. Yeah, and glimpses is probably the right word. It's very subtle, and it does leave a lot to our imagination, which I appreciated. But I am curious if you were, let's say, handed the budget Steven Spielberg had on Minority Report, which is a movie I was thinking about when I was watching the car scenes the discrepancy between the way you approach those scenes, which still tells us everything we need to know, and focuses on those characters versus it being about the chaotic future world. Would you as a filmmaker want to utilize those resources to paint on that type of canvas? Or even if you had it available to you, would you be like, this is the story I'm trying to tell, this is the way I want to do it?
Certainly at that time, no. You know, I was just, I think I even had written in the script that there was going to be, and I didn't even imagine like any kind of budget for it. So I was already sort of thinking about the story I wanted to tell. And I had really started telling people that it's really a story of interiority. I think, you know, obviously Yang's interior and Jake, you know, getting lost in his own thoughts and memories. And so I wanted it even to physically for it to be an interior story. And I think at one point I had written the script, you never see the world, outside world except through windows and reflections. And, you know, and we did end up showing, you know, two or three shots that felt like the world. But I had was never really interested in only seeing it through, you know, certain spaces, but to keep it largely in the house of this family and then in these auto cars to kind of get a little feeling of it. But really, it's also about being, you know, inside that car and seeing the, you know, feeling any kind of exterior through the windows.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was always a part of the plan. But, you know, it's interesting because even, yeah, I mean, you know, obviously since then I've done Pachinko and I have been thinking about, you know, immersive possibilities. But yeah, I don't know if I would, you know, I would probably spend the money on other things, you know, like, you know, like you know, what I really longed for was I did explain the house and the city as like a city in a forest, you know, which I always have wanted to see. And, but, you know, there was just like some limits to that. And I might have built that world out a bit. But yeah, I don't think it would have been that much different.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier that you're not shooting a lot of coverage. And I think that that's apparent to anyone who's probably paying any kind of attention to both of these films. But there are moments in the film where as we see different memories played back, we see variations on certain line readings. And I wanted to ask you about how you came up with those variations. Were those things that were scripted and shot very specifically and deliberately to have that kind of tone or that alteration in tone? Were they, you know, then sort of carefully orchestrated in that way? Or did you give the actors room to interpret and vary?
Is this something you believe? That the end is also a beginning? Is also the beginning?
The film has these different realities. Some are human memories, some are Yang's memory, some are the camera, you know, and all of those do have a visual element. Like my, me and the DP said, hey, you know, we won't make it obvious. I don't want to use like tinted, you know, lens or have like some, you know, time code that, you know, but through cinema, through what we have in film, you know, let's understand that when we're experiencing Yang, we're going to use this lens and this aspect ratio, and the form will be a little bit different. And when we're in human memory, and this was, I was very excited about this, you know, I said, I'm going to use this repetition. And I kind of explained to him this idea and he understood it, but I never told the actors that, you know, so for the actors, they were just going to do these scenes a different way. They were just going to do it, and we were going to do it as different takes. And through the conversation, I did have them try different things. You know, there was a moment when I could see that Justin was feeling very emotional, but he was trying to restrain it as being a, you know, but I kind of knew that, oh, that would be very interesting if, because it's a human memory, you know, for that subjectivity. And that's what I was interested in, is that, So anyway, all that to say, we just did different takes of it, because I also felt like the way I wanted to deal with human memory and subjectivity was that we are often almost auditioning takes. You know, in my mind, there was something about cinema itself that was so, cinema is capturing memories and then figuring out what is, you know, and so there was something about human memory that feels like that. You know, you study human memory and they say that every time you recall a memory, it's different. It's never like a computer. You never remember the same thing over and over, you know, in the exact same way. And so there was just some element of this idea that you are moving through different takes of something to try to get to, I don't know, even know if we were trying to get to the truth of it. I think the other thing that's interesting to me is, and the thing that I love about human memory versus what we have on our phone is if we don't have this objective view of it, I think depending on what, why we're searching in our minds for a memory, we are reshaping that memory. And there's something about the sweetness of those memories and the elusiveness that was really interesting to me. Like, you know, talking about catching up to grief, I don't know. I think in some ways those memories were more meaningful in their recollection of it than maybe it would have been if we just had a, you know, like some objective view of it.
Yeah.
And so when Yang is feeling, you know, when she imagines him feeling sad, you know, I don't know if that's true or not. But I also like that idea that I don't know. You know, there's something mm-hmm. also very collective about those moments too, that feels almost also like a collective memory. But so that was kind of the approach to it.
So a lot to dive into there, and picking up specifically on the memory part, that first time through Yang's memories, we see Jake experiencing what Yang is experiencing and what he's seeing, and that entire montage and picking those moments, which in many ways could be described, I suppose, by someone as insignificant, but those are often what we hold on to. We don't always get to pick and choose what we think is consequential from our lives. And the little details are the things that sometimes we really do latch onto. And I'm thinking of one shot, for example, that's from Yang's point of view. I think he might even be outside looking through the glass, and he's seeing Jake and Kieran. They're just sitting on the couch, and he might have his arm around her. Yeah. The fact that that's something that he's clinging to.
Yeah.
How did you go about deciding, and did you mine in a personal way, which I'm imagining you did based on everything you've said about the film and your approach, those types of moments from your own life that matter most?
Yeah, it was a bit of both, or maybe there were a number of things, you know, in regard to like what would Jake discover in Yang, and also knowing that Jake, you know, that he is feeling disconnected and lost, and you know, knowing that kind of feeling in my own life, and what is it that attunes me back to this world, you know, and sometimes we think it's going to be something really like a real otherworldly revelation, you know, and sometimes it's as simple as something that feels very ordinary and mundane. Mm-hmm. So there's that kind of like trying to understand, again, the mystery of Yang, and trying to figure out what Yang is recollecting or what Yang is feeling is worth storing, you know, and being surprised by that, you know? And so initially, you know, you see this girl and there's something very provocative about it, but then, when you kind of start going further back and getting into family life, you know, he, a lot of his life was being at home, you know, a lot of his life was just, you know, and so just finding the beauty there, finding things that felt meaningful. And also, as I was unpacking that, early on, I didn't know that he was going to have deeper layers, you know, that we were going to find that his sense of time was far more profound than we would imagine. And once I understood, too, that he had lived such a full life, you know, that he was in many ways like a grandparent, you know, you imagine that he's maybe 7 years old, you know, in the same way that, mm-hmm. that Mika is. And then you realize, oh, he's the oldest being in that house, you know, and then recognizing that older people have a deeper, I can feel it in myself. I remember when I was a kid, my parents always being like, oh, the flowers look so great today, and taking walks. And I just thought, God, this sounds awful. I hope I'm never like this such a boring person that I talk about what a tree looks like today, or the weather, or a flower. And then all of a sudden I see myself thinking like, God, those the blooms look great. You know, I'm trying to let my sons like pay attention, like look at that tree. And there is something just about aging where it's funny what you start imagining is meaningful. And so there was also this sort of reverse, like now at this point we imagine him as 7, but he's an old soul, you know, and there is something about seeing shadows on the wall or a tree that he's noticing in the way that, you know, the older people around us or anyone, you know, who's attuned might notice.
All the cinema talk set up nicely the last thing I wanted to explore with you a little bit, which is my favorite joke in the movie, and we'll see if you intended it as something with a wink, is actually, I think, the culmination of that scene where Jake gets interrupted by Mika and she asks him if he's watching a movie, and he says, just a documentary.
Yeah.
and of course, it is very much a documentary.
Yeah, yeah.
But it did make me think that it's not by accident that you, as a film lover and someone who has spent a lot of your life thinking seriously about film and analyzing it, and obviously making films as well, that you would approach it that way. And one of the things the movie gets into near the end, it raises this idea. I think it's Haley Lou Richardson's character who says, "What's so great about being human anyway?" Mm-hmm. Or you know, what's this notion of the superiority? And I think that we're inherently inclined. There's a certain solipsism in humanity where we assume we're the only creatures that matter, and we can't we just can't even imagine life any other way. And cinema, for me, feels like the closest thing, the same way that he puts on those glasses and actually then has a window into Yang's perception. It feels to me that isn't that what cinema is when you go into the theater and you look at that screen? It's the closest thing we get to that window into what life might actually be like for another entity, another human.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's so, you know, I didn't realize until I got a chance to program with the American Cinematheque in L.A., like a second feature with my film the week or 2 weeks before it came out. And I had paired one of them with Tony Takatani, but the other with Afterlife. And of course, Afterlife had such a, you know, I didn't realize how much my film was in conversation with Afterlife until I programmed it. And I was like, oh God, as influences work, you know, is there just deep inside of you? And I just thought, you know, I've always thought Afterlife was about filmmaking as well. I think I did a video essay about it, and it was always felt to me about that. And I didn't ever think about After Yang as being about filmmaking, but it is largely, and I see this in Afterlife too, you know, where they had to choose one memory that was significant. And it was really this sort of pursuit of like, what is the memory in human life that I want to live in for all the rest of my life? And, you know, and a lot of it is mundane, and a lot of it is, you know, and I think, you know, there is something about Koreeda, who's also sort of mining, you know, this question of what is worth seeing, you know, in his films too, and what is valuable. So I know that that's there. Yeah, I think for sure. And you know, even the way in which we knew we were doing sci-fi, I know the conversation I had with Benjamin was that I wasn't as interested in special effects as much as I was in the way that the language of cinema could be our special effect, you know, that an aspect ratio or movement or, and I think if someone ever wanted to watch the film more than once and really, you know, that there's a lot there that Benjamin and I have that you would be able to peel layers in our film and have a deeper sense of it, you know, and from the very beginning. And, you know, I think that family camera scene that, you know, has a lot of layers to it. And there's just something about cinema itself that was really a part of the way we were trying to get to the realities of this film. So yeah, for sure.
Since we're in a safe space and I feel comfortable being vulnerable, I will admit that I have long regretted, I still have not seen Afterlife. And I have seen, I've seen other Koreeda films and enjoyed them, but he's been on that short list of names that we really feel like we need to do a deep dive film spotting marathon on and fill in some of those blind spots. It sounds like you would encourage that.
I would encourage. In fact, if you do it, can I join you for one of those?
Please.
Yeah, let's do it.
I was almost going to impose and already write you down and ask if you join us for it, but
that'd
be incredible.
Sign me up.
We will definitely bump it up the list.
Yeah.
After Yang it's only April as we're taping this here, but for myself and my co-host is the film of the year. And I think a chance to remain that way. Yeah. So thank you so much for your time and your insights and your thoughtfulness. As always, it was great to reconnect with you.
Yeah. Well, I hope this is a tradition. I'm wanting to talk to you after every film. So, thank you for saying that. That actually means so much, you know, coming from you guys. So I deeply appreciate it. And thanks for the time.
Thank you.
What are you watching?
My sincere thanks again to Ko Ganada. His After Yang is currently playing in limited release. It's also playing exclusively on Showtime. Unfortunately, I stopped recording there at the conclusion of our conversation, and you didn't get to hear the 10 minutes more or so that we chatted. And one of the topics he was enthusiastic to discuss was some of the new film reading he's been doing. He remembered the Film Spotting Five the last time he was on the show. The fifth question in that series is to tell us about a favorite book you have read about film or filmmaking. And he had three. He was eager to talk about the first one. No surprise. He wasn't even aware of the connection to our show and the fact that she is part of the Buster Keaton Marathon we're going to get back into here in a few weeks. Cameraman, Buster Keaton, The Dawn of Cinema and the Invention of the 20th Century by Dana Stevens. He was absolutely gushing about, if you haven't had a chance to check out that book yet. The Cinema of Ozu Yasujiro, Histories of the Everyday by Wu Zhongzhu. You heard Koganada reference him in our conversation. His name is actually derived from one of Ozu's longtime collaborators, huge influence on his work, and basically said about this book that it says everything he would ever want to say or hope to say about Ozu and his films. Finally, one I was completely unfamiliar with and now can't wait to check out, Michael Koreski's new book called Films of Endearment, A Mother, A Son, and the 80s Films That Defined Us. I will link to all three of these books over in our show notes at filmspotting.net. Coming up, Film Spotting Madness Best of the 70s and a review of After Yang from our friends at the Next Picture Show.
Concerning the fate of every single world of our infinite multiverse.
There is no way I am the Evelyn you are looking for.
You're listening to Film Spotting. That's from the trailer for Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, the much-hyped, much-celebrated in its limited-run multiverse tale starring Michelle Yeoh. It's from the directing team Daniels, and it expands into wide release this weekend. Josh and I will have a review next week on the show. That is, if he ever gets done reviewing Jaws. We might also devote a segment to some of the Nicolas Cage homework we've been doing in anticipation of our top five Cage performances a couple of weeks from now. That show, very much inspired by The Age of Cage, the new book from friend of the show and co-host of the Next Picture Show, Keith Phipps. We've got three options that we are kicking around if we go this route. All anniversaries, it works out quite nicely. Moonstruck, 35 years. Or we could talk about Face Off. It's been 25 years. Adaptation, 20 years since its release. So far in early voting on Twitter, the numbers are in favor of Face Off, 41%. We have Adaptation close behind, 36%. Alas, Moonstruck, my favorite of the three, in last place, 23% of the vote. But our listeners might be right in terms of the film that might be the most fruitful for a revisit and for conversation. Big fan, as I said, of Moonstruck. Big fan as well of Adaptation. Face Off, however, upon its release, didn't do a whole lot for me. And maybe I will have a new opinion here 25 years later. I have not seen it since I saw it in the theater 25 years ago, whereas I feel like my opinion on Moonstruck and Adaptation probably isn't going to move much. You can stay on top of our show plans at filmspotting.net/episodes and We encourage you to subscribe to the weekly Film Spotting newsletter at filmspotting.net/newsletter. We love to give away free stuff. Up first, we've got 5 Blu-ray copies of Kenneth Branagh's Death on the Nile, newly available on digital, 4K Ultra HD, Blu-ray, and DVD. It's based on, of course, Agatha Christie's beloved novel and features an all-star cast. It will keep you guessing all the way to its final shocking conclusion. The new disc has deleted scenes, behind-the-scenes featurettes, and more. If you want to win one of those 5 Blu-ray copies, all you have to do is send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net, put Death on the Nile in your subject line, and tell us, in the body of the email, what your favorite Kenneth Branagh-directed film is. You could try to butter me up and say, of course, that it's Henry V. You could say we were way too hard on Belfast and his Oscar-winning film deserves way more love. You could go with something like Dead Again, which got some love from me during our recent top 5 Hitchcockian films. You could say Thor, but I would automatically delete your entry. Feedback@filmspotting.net is the address. Death on the Nile is available now on digital and on 4K, Ultra HD, Blu-ray, and DVD. We also have, for our Chicago area listeners, an advanced screening opportunity to see a highly anticipated film I know by many of our listeners, Robert Eggers' The Northman. It comes to theaters on April 27th. The screening is going to be at 7 p.m. downtown on Monday, April 14th. If you would like to win a chance to get free Admit 2 passes, just go to filmspotting.net, find this episode, and you will find the direct link to enter in the notes for this show, or you can go to our Twitter feed at Filmspotting and find the link there.
This is blasphemy. This is madness.
This is absolute madness.
Spare this madness.
But this is absolute madness, Ambassador. Why should you build such a thing?
Madness. This is Sparta!
That's right. It's time for our Film Spotting Madness update. Best of the 70s, 64 films enter, only one survives. The championship matchup is set. It's time to name the best film of the 1970s. You can vote now. Filmspotting.net/madness. Before I get to that championship matchup, let's look at the final 4 results. It was all heavyweights, all the blue bloods. We had The Godfather going up against The Godfather Part 2. And Star Wars, A New Hope versus Spielberg's Jaws, the 2 box office hits that redefine really how Hollywood worked, going up against each other. Only one of them can survive. The Godfather matchup went as you probably expected. Godfather 1 over Godfather 2, 68-32%. Here's Justin Zimmerman. If I were to graph the greatness of The Godfather over the course of its running time, the graph would be a straight line, a plateau of greatness from start to finish. My graph for The Godfather Part 2 would show higher peaks of greatness, but also valleys. Perhaps they even out in the end, but only the flawless film escapes the Film Spotting incinerator. There's Justin applying math to Film Spotting Madness, which we always appreciate, even if we don't understand here on the show. Yes, The Godfather advances. How about Star Wars versus Jaws? Much closer, maybe no surprise there. Last week, I suggested that Star Wars may be the film that's moving on. Now, maybe I misread the early poll results, or maybe early on, Star Wars was in the lead, and it seemed like it was trending in the right direction. However, Jaws, well, it bit back. Here's Alan. He says, it all depends if I go with my heart or with my head. Jaws is a better film, and as time continues to march on, it holds up better than A New Hope. But from my heart, I can still remember standing in a line that wrapped around the block to buy a ticket for a Star Wars showing 8 hours later because all other screenings were sold out. I played with the action figures, had the posters, and the lunchboxes. It truly is part of my makeup. It finally came down to this question. If both of these films were being thrown into the incinerator tonight and I could only watch one last time, which would it be? Alan says it would be Star Wars, and he notes in parentheses the original 1977 version. Well, guess what? Applying that same logic, Alan, that's why I voted for it as well, but we were in the minority. More film spotting listeners out there going with their heads over their hearts. Jaws advances 55% to 45%. That does mean that the best film of the 70s will either be The Godfather or Jaws. The Godfather's road to the championship, it took down The Black Stallion, Hal Ashby's Harold and Maude, Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Alien, and The Godfather Part 2. And not a single one of those matchups was close. Jaws, it beat Charles Burnett's Killer of Sheep, John Cassavetes' A Woman Under the Influence, Milos Forman's Best Picture winning One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and yeah, it took down Coppola's Apocalypse Now and Star Wars. So, you tell us, you get to decide once and for all what is the best film of the 1970s. Is it The Godfather or is it Jaws? And there is a bronze medal, the third place film, The Godfather Part 2, or Star Wars. I have a feeling the heart is going to win out on this one. I have not glanced at the results. I am intrigued to see where it currently stands. And taking a quick glance at it, it looks like, oh man, it's close. The head and the heart are really duking it out. Your vote may decide the third place title. Godfather Part 2 or Star Wars, vote now. Filmspotting.net/madness. We do have a prediction contest. Why have a bracket? If you don't have a prediction contest, the winner gets a very exciting Film Spotting prize pack and gets the opportunity to compete in our internal Film Spotting Madness competition, which has a very special prize, or at least a very special penalty, as we'll talk about here in a moment. And right now, it's Brett Fisher's to lose. Brett in Portland, Oregon. He has been in first place for four consecutive weeks, and he does have The Godfather over Jaws in the finals. If he is correct, and there's a very good chance he's correct, Brett is going to do something actually pretty incredible. I don't know, Brett, if you've had a tough week or not, if maybe, you know, your family or coworkers or something aren't properly appreciating you. They need to listen to this segment and understand how incredible you are. What a feat you have accomplished. We have only been doing the prediction contest for 3 years out of the last eight of doing Film Spotting Madness. I went back and looked at the number of correct guesses in the winning bracket. And if you look back at 2020, I believe the number was 56. There may have been one or two people who correctly picked 57 of the 63 matchups correctly, but the winning bracket in terms of overall points got 56 right. The next year, 2021, and I may have these inverted, but the point stands. 2021, 53 for the winning bracket out of 63, 54 on some brackets, but the winner got 53 of 63 right. That's formidable. If Brett correctly picked The Godfather over Jaws, he will have gotten 62 out of 63 matchups right. The only one he missed, one that I incorrectly guessed as well, would be Dawn of the Dead and Days of Heaven. Back in round one, he thought Romero and the zombies would take Malick down. It didn't happen. Days of Heaven advanced, but that's the only one he got wrong. That's incredible, Brett. Congratulations. If you hang on, you truly do deserve it. In our internal contest, me, Josh, our producer, Sam, Film Spotting Madness Godfather listener, Mike Merrigan, and last year's winner, Andy Hampton in Madison, Wisconsin, we duke it out and the loser has to suffer. That has traditionally meant watching an Adam Sandler Netflix joint. We still haven't figured out what the new penalty will be, and we're open to suggestions. But Andy, currently last year's winner, he's in a three-way tie. He's doing it again. Fourth place overall. Great showing by Andy. He also has The Godfather beating Jaws in the final. Myself and Sam, we had The Godfather going up against Star Wars in the final. We we dropped to 238th place. Josh, he had Jaws making the finals. Well done, Josh. He's up to 141st. And that would worry me. That would worry Sam, except Mike Merrigan. He had The Godfather Part 2 beating One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in the final. Mike is now in 676th place out of nearly 800 predictions. That means no Adam Sandler or no punishment for us. Happy watching, Mike. You can vote in the championship match now through Monday the 11th at 11 a.m. Central Time. Monday the 11th at 11 a.m. is when polls close. We'll announce the winner on next week's show.
The memory banks allowed the technos to record a few seconds each day. The labs were trying to understand what technos considered memorable. But the research was uncovered. The whole project was shut down immediately for violating privacy laws.
So what do I do?
Oh, I'm not going to lie. This is a big deal.
Well, if you're a regular listener of the show, you've already heard our take on After Yang. You also, earlier in this episode, heard my thoughts along with the director, Koganada's. Now, we're going to do something a little bit different and get another take. That's Sarita Chowdhury with Colin Farrell in Koganada's After Yang. You can find our previous conversation about that film over at filmspotting.net. It was episode 864. This week, we wanted to share what the Next Picture Show had to say about it. The Next Picture Show is our sister podcast. And if you haven't given them a listen yet, the concept is looking at cinema's present via its past. They pair up current films with older films that either were direct inspirations or can be thematically linked in some way. And they've been doing it for a long time. They have over 300 episodes recorded. Recent pairings include the new 70s set horror movie X from Ty West, along with 1974's The Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Steven Soderbergh's Kimmy with 1998's Run, Lola, Run. Their pairings are always inspired. They are also always incredibly cleverly titled. The Next Picture Show is hosted by Tasha Robinson, Keith Phipps, Genevieve Kosky, and Scott Tobias. For their After Yang episodes, they revisited Steven Spielberg's AI, Artificial Intelligence. We're going to share the After Yang half of their discussion, but you may hear a few references to AI, which they talked about on a previous episode. And if you do want to hear them talk about AI in detail and hear the links they made between the two films, just do a search for The Next Picture Show or find them wherever you get your podcasts. Here's The Next Picture Show crew and their review of After Yang.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here again with
Keith Phipps,
Tasha Robinson,
and Genevieve Kosky.
On last week's episode, we talked about AI, Artificial Intelligence, a science fiction film about an uncommonly sophisticated android who gets adopted by a family and goes on a journey to find them after they can no longer have him in the house. This week, we're bringing in After Yang, the new film by Koganada, who made a striking independent debut with the 2017 film Columbus. After Yang is also about a sophisticated android who gets adopted by a family, but he malfunctions and breaks down right after the opening credits. And so the journey in the film is not taken by a robot, but by a father, Jake, played by Colin Farrell. Yang is the name of the quote-unquote techno-sapien that Jake and his wife, Kira, played by Jodie Turner-Smith, picked up for their own adopted daughter as an older brother type. Though as two busy parents, they've been leaning too hard on Yang to fill in the caretaking gaps. So like any overcompensating father, Jake promises his daughter, Mika, that he's going to get Yang repaired, even though he bought a refurbished model from a shop in Chinatown that no longer exists. So in the absence of a genius bar, Jake tries to get the android fixed in various repair shops, but at a certain point, when it's clear repair isn't possible, he becomes interested in accessing Yang's memories and understanding the philosophical mysteries at his core. After Yang could be thought about as a live-action Inside Out, and that Yang's component parts allow us to break down the inner workings of the human mind. But it's also a film about grief, identity, memory, and finally, the meaning of life itself. So what did you think of After Yang, Genevieve Kosky?
Oh, we're starting with me.
Yeah.
I really loved it. It kind of devastated me for a fair amount of time afterwards. I think it really got to me most as a film about grief and memory. And I will say I semi-recently lost a dog. It's still like really hard for me. And my phone is delivering photos to me every day, little like flashes of memory of him. And I just kept thinking of that during those sequences of Colin Farrell, like going through, like those sequences are very impressively done and just like very cool on a editing filmmaking level. But I feel like I was just processing those sequences through this like different, but kind of similar personal experience I'm going through. So I think that's where I really just like locked into the emotional core of this in a way that maybe obscured some other parts of it. But I will say also that I think what initially struck me most about this film was the world, the look of it. And I've talked before on this podcast how I'm like really prone to like locking into interesting worlds, and world building is like something that I really glom onto with films. And we didn't talk about it in the AI half, but it is something that I was really drawn to in that film. And there was so much in this world that I like wanted to know more about, but the fact that I came out of this movie like not feeling frustrated that I didn't know why there were plants inside all of the vehicles for some reason, I think kind of underlines that for me, like the emotional center of this film did end up taking center stage.
Okay, that's fascinating. I had almost the exact opposite reaction. And yet very much a similar reaction. I also fixated on the plants in the cars. But to me, I mean, that was just sort of emblematic of how I responded to the film in general. I did not have a huge emotional response to most of this film. There's a sequence that is out on the internet. A24 put it out as a promo. That's the opening credits where the four-person family at the heart of the movie is competing in an off-screen dance competition. Uh-huh. And you just see the moves that they're making as they're directed by an off-screen voice as, I forget, but I think it's something like 30,000 participants at the beginning, and then they're eliminated in batches of many thousands at once. And you see them competing and several other people who will come up later in the film competing with their own families. And it's just such an explosive moment of like verve in terms of like the music and the motion, everything going on. And I kept wanting to come back to something like that throughout the film, which is very quiet and very intellectual and very heady. But I didn't have much of an emotional response to most of it, apart from one moment that I think we'll get into in a little bit. But I found myself afterward just like not able to let it go. It's such a densely constructed movie in a way different from AI, which is constantly throwing imagery and dialogue at you. In this case, it's the movie's like constantly quietly layering ideas and emotions and scene setting details like the moss in the cars that just leaves you with a lot to pick apart. So I had a much more like chilly intellectual response to most of this movie rather than a huge gushy emotional one. But I still came out with a huge respect for how it's constructed, and it's just really stuck with me. I just find myself going back to individual moments, individual scenes and thoughts and lines and aesthetic choices with the filmmaking. I think it's a really remarkable film, but it's not a film that I had the giant emotional response to that you did.
Our friend Sam Adams had a piece where he interviewed Coconutton and wrote about the film. It's very good. We'll link to it somewhere. But he talks about how it is, there's so much going on, you could focus on one element and kind of, you know, maybe less on others. And the first time through, I really focused on, you know, what the story was and the mystery of Yang and where this was going, to the point where when you kind of get it at the heart of the mystery, it's so small and personal and emotional. It is overwhelming. It creeps up on you. The second time through, I was really kind of trying to untangle a bit of the world that we kind of only see glimpses of and what that would mean. And you know, reading Sam's piece and a piece by Leo Kim on Polygon, you know, talking about the identity element of it too, like, because he is a Yang, is a robot, if not originally designed for, being used to help acclimate a child adapted from China. I'm kind of rambling around it, but yeah, there's a lot going on in this, but I think it's dense in a way that invites exploration. And I think really comes into focus in those moments when it dwells in the emotions and they do hit really hard. I like this film a lot. I like Coconata's first film, Columbus, and I'm really enjoying Pachinko so far. I'm only three episodes into that, but
we'll do a bonus episode on Pachinko for sure.
Without no spoilers, but the end of the third episode, good lord. Okay, anyway, carry on.
Also, and this will actually tie back into what Tasha brought about the dance sequence. Real quick noting, the opening credits of Pachinko are some of my favorite ever. They're so good. And I think the dance sequence in After Yang, like, it's an opening credits sequence. You know, it culminates in Yang's malfunctioning. So I guess it, in that one small way, it's important to the plot. But really, it feels to me just kind of like a standalone opening credits sequence, you know, and it doesn't necessarily relate to the rest of the movie on a thematic or tonal level. And to be like kind of cynical about it, I feel that A24 in releasing it was maybe trying to like catch on to some Ex Machina vibes like attractive actor doing a interesting dance thing, but it does not really fit, I don't think, with the rest of the movie. And as Tasha said, it never really gets back to that type of energy level. But I think it's sort of a getting you excited to watch the movie sequence. It's really effective.
It's only the second time through that I realized it was the rest of the cast doing the dance scene. It's like, oh, hey, that's Clifton Collins Jr. and Serena Chatter.
I love the mechanics of that, though, because it does... They do just seem like a bunch of random strangers that you're seeing. It feels like back at the Dissolve, Genevieve and I did a podcast bonus episode about the DreamWorks dance party ending and how you parade all the characters out to have a big dance at the end because you don't know how else to end your movie with a bunch of zazz. And it just became a very standard thing for animated movies for a while. And this kind of feels like front loading that. But then when you realize, I recognized Clifton Collins and Sarita Chowdhury the first time through and thought, okay, that's interesting. They must be in this film somewhere. But when we get deeper into the film and we realize we never do see the other three people that each of them have dancing with them in those sequences, those are just like little windows into their families and their lives. And it's such an invitation to parts of the movie, parts of the world that we never see, parts of their personal lives that we never see. It's such a provocative little tease. And like so many things in this movie, it's just a hugely dense thing that you're gently invited to unpack on your own because the movie isn't going to do it for you.
My reaction to the film was similar to Genevieve's. It was just a huge gut punch for me. And I am quite a distance away from it. I was fortunate enough to see it in a theater and was a complete disaster in the parking garage after I saw it. I think, you know, and it has been for me, you know, a year and kind of, it sort of continues. And it was actually a review that I started writing in the first person, which I never do ever, never done ever in my whole career. And then I decided to scrap it because I just didn't feel comfortable doing it. And also just even really sharing what was kind of going on. But I did feel like I connected as to be just a sliver personal. You know, I'm not a believer, really. I'm not a churchgoer. And it felt the film kind of, I consider myself sort of a glass half full atheist. And I feel like the film kind of connected with me powerfully on that level of just like, when you are a person such as myself, life becomes incredibly significant. You're not thinking about, and to the extent that you're thinking about the afterlife, you're thinking about how lives seed other lives and affect other lives, and for the film to kind of vibe on that a little bit, I felt the film really resonated on that very specific level of just that understanding of this android that absolutely does not have an afterlife. I think we can pretty much, you know, I don't think there's a robot heaven here, but whose life is determined to be significant because of the influence that he had on the lives of others. I mean, that was what really got to me, you know, and I'm intellectualizing it now, but I think that's what kind of accounted for how hard it hit me when I was, you know, when I was sort of after the film. I just kind of like that take on the meaning of life. And I mean, that was what got to me about After Yang, you know, on top of everything else. And this is something that Sam mentioned in the piece, is like, you could leave that movie and write a pretty long list of the themes of, mm-hmm. of After Yang. Oh, yeah. It is a film. It is a rich text and that has been thoroughly thought through by Koganada here. Yeah. So that was basically my basic response to the movie. I was quite moved by it.
Was it the scene where Kira and Yang are talking about the improbability of an afterlife specifically that prompted that reaction, or was it just the greater whole of the film?
I think it was the scene that I keep going, a couple of scenes I go back. I mean, it's the ending of the movie. I just, so sweet. With the father and daughter, and that amazing cover of the song from All About Lily Shoo Shoo that Mitski does, and the way that leads, that is just so great. And I think there's also the scene where we flash back to Yang teaching Mika about the tree, right, and about how she
the grafting,
yeah. Right, of just how, you know, she's not maybe made to think that she's not a part of this family, but she is, and she's created something new, that she's bonded to this tree and has become part of it forever, you know. And I just like those kind of ideas, you know, seeded in the movie. I mean, I think there's just a you know, this is a very unusual science fiction movie because, you know, it's so emotional. And I think that its worldview is fundamentally optimistic, which is, again, not something we're used to seeing in a futuristic science fiction movie. That doesn't mean that it's without its moments of bleakness, but I think there's a warmth to this film that is quite striking.
See this branch? This branch is also from another tree. But look. You're connected to Mom and Dad just like this branch. You're part of the family tree. For real.
Then, so are you. Why do they do it? Why do they move branches to different trees?
It's called grafting. They do it to make something new. Some of the apples you love were produced by combining different trees. It's an ancient technique that was used in China over 4,000 years ago.
A Chinese fun fact?
Yes. But you should know that both trees are important. Not just this one, but the one from this branch too. Your other family tree is also a vital part of who you are. Do you understand?
So while we're getting personal, I alluded earlier to the fact that there was one thing in the movie that really undid me emotionally. And talking about the tree grafting scene, I'm not sure how much I associated, how much I put these factors together while actually watching the movie. Again, it's been a little while, but the thing that undid me was a different visual of a tree. There's a moment in the film where Colin Farrell finds out that Yang had an internal recorder that could record very small snippets of memory. And he interfaces with it. The visual is just him sitting on a futon with dark glasses on, talking to the dark glasses. But then you see the point of view of this AR interface where he's entering Yang's memory for the first time and visualizing it. And he realizes that there's more there than he realized. And he opens up a second menu and it appears as this, wow. It appears as this giant branching tree of connected memories. Mm-hmm. And it's a tree and it's like a galaxy of stars at the same time. It's a really aesthetically beautiful image. But, you know, for me, what that opened up is just one of the things that I've been most obsessed with, I think, throughout my life, is just this feeling that everybody contains that kind of vast, complicated galaxy. And when people die, we lose any interface with it at all. We lose any window into it. But for the most part, it's just very hard to access any meaningful percentage of that in any one in any one person. It's so difficult to connect to each other in any kind of way that reflects how vast our inner worlds are. And this was a visual image that communicates that in 1 second. And then as he slowly starts moving deeper into this tree and examining these memories, he basically gets to live inside somebody else's skin. And much like with AI, the movie doesn't explain this to us. He doesn't say any of this to anybody later. He doesn't talk about the profundity of wearing Yang's skin and living his life. But the idea of having that intimate connection to somebody else is overwhelming to me. And then the idea of being able to use something like that to understand somebody who's gone, who you can't speak to about how you understand them in a new way, I think is heartbreaking and part of the human condition, you know, just the what we lose when people die. So yeah, a lot of kind of visual elements to this movie that just tap into like gigantic, hard to fathom, hard to communicate ideas about the human condition in very simple, but it like evocative aesthetic ways.
It's so interesting to me that you point that out as the scene, Tasha, because it's the same scene I was referring to when I was talking to how it knocked me out, but I was processing it in a just a different way, a more external way, I think, in terms of how humans and technology and memory work together. And like that visual, like I said, I was processing as my phone giving me memories of my dead dog every day and the little like pull down screen of memory, you know, of today's memories. And just the feeling that you get these like little snippets of something that was so important and so big and so real. And you just have this like little tiny glimpse of it, infinite tiny glimpses, but it's still not the whole. It's still not the thing. But again, to go back to the rich text of it all, the way you read it, absolutely. Like I get that too. So I think it's a very much a movie that like what you bring to it is going to inform how you interpret any given moment or visual even.
I think it's smart and kind of lovely too that we only do get those little snippets too, because he doesn't really get to relive Yang's life. He gets to have these suggestions of it. And I think it's also kind of captures how memory works. I mean, they are these really, you know, pointed, powerful flashes. You don't have flashbacks. You have something more like akin to this, which is like, I remember being at that show and how, you know, someone I loved looked at that show and or, you know, I remember walking down this pathway and, you know, it is more like that than an extended flashback. When we do get a flashback in this, it is a living person recalling it too. And it's so nicely done the way they show that opening, that scene of the photograph being taken from different angles and different perspectives. And I don't know. There's a lot to unpack. And the more you unpack, I think the more there's to admire in this film.
So just to add a yet another wrinkle on top of all of this, the piece that we put up at Polygon today that Keith referenced earlier is from an Asian writer who's written a lot about techno-orientalism and what he calls the hollow Asian body, the stereotype. This is a science fiction trope that I was not aware of, and I'll leave it to him. We'll point to it in the show notes, I'm sure. I'll leave it to him to unpack because it's complicated and there's a long history in science fiction. But effectively, he came to me wanting to write about this idea that science fiction marginalizes Asian people, particularly in ways that presents them as cold and unfeeling, like complicated calculators, good at math, not good at emotions, and effectively creates the idea of a hollow Asian body that other people can put on and insert themselves into. And I read this pitch and he hadn't seen the movie yet. And I said, you have to see this movie. So I sent him to see it. And it fit so clearly into his thesis. We just kind of geeked out about it for a while. And he ended up writing a piece about it and then talking to the director, who said, yeah, this is exactly what I'm addressing. So on top of all of these experiences that we personally had with our own interfaces with this idea of entering Yang's body, it's also very specifically addressing a science fiction trope mm-hmm. of Asians being empty people, except in this case, the white guy enters the Asian body, and instead of finding it empty because the literal Asian robot is a calculator, he finds it full of a far vaster and richer life than he possibly could have imagined, and gains access to it. So all of us are having these very individual interactions and responses to it, but it's also in conversation with all of science fiction history and an entire like range of racist, like prejudicial stereotypes that are out in the culture. It's dealing with all of those things and Koganada's like own life and own history and own culture at the same time. It's just, it's ridiculous how far down the rabbit hole this movie goes.
Just to tag on to what Tasha was talking about and also recommend yet another piece written by a friend of the show, Allison Wilmore, who reviewed it for Vulture. And she also kind of honed in on the Asian tropes of sci-fi, but on a much more visual level, and how especially in like Asian inflected futures are often very dystopian. And these borrowed trappings, a symptom of societies becoming more callous and crowded, more foreign around main characters who invariably aren't. And she was really taken with the warmth and the unfussiness of the way that the film works its Asian influences into its world building. So I think that's yet another piece worth reading if this element of the film isn't of interest to you.
Yeah, for sure. The sort of pan-Asian influences in the like the architecture, the kind of kimono style clothing that everyone wears, the presence of bonsai trees, the particular
kind
of
ramen
wall hangings, the eating of ramen, the fact that Colin Farrell's career is in running a tea shop where he's very tied up in like the aesthetic experience of tea. There's a ton of kind of like Asian culture trappings to this future without that sense of like over technologicalization. Is that a word? Without the sort of burden of technology that we see in so many futures like Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049.
Yeah. I mean, the world of the film is kind of fascinating to unpack, just the how unspecific it is while also being very specific. You know, I mean, yeah. like it's full of these details of the flowers growing in cars and it has strong ideas about, you know, what people wear and how they interact and what their homes look like and that sort of thing. But it's not interested in telling us when this is going to be, or how the world came to be this way. Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily have a strong opinion one way or the other about how we're supposed to feel about this about this world. It just is kind of like this really interestingly drawn thing that we can kind of play around in a little bit.
Did Yang want to be human?
That's such a human thing to ask, isn't it?
Tasha, Scott, Genevieve, and Keith from our sister podcast, The Next Picture Show, and their conversation about the new After Yang. Please do check out that series, their two-part series focusing on After Yang and AI, artificial intelligence, and you can find their archive of episodes as well. That's our show. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Letterboxd. I'm at FilmSpotting. Josh is at Larson on Film. In the show archives at filmspotting.net, you can find reviews, interviews, and top fives going back all the way to 2005. And at our website, you can also vote in the championship round of Film Spotting Madness Best of the 70s. 64 films enter, only one will remain. Will it be The Godfather or will it be Jaws? To order t-shirts or other merch, visit filmspotting.net/shop. And filmspotting.net/newsletter is where you can subscribe to receive our weekly newsletter. Out on digital this weekend, Andrea Arnold's Cow. It's a close-up portrait of the lives of two cows. That comes to us from the director of American Honey and Fish Tank. No, it is not fiction. In wide release, Ambulance, the new one from Michael Bay. Sonic the Hedgehog 2 is out, and expanding wide, a movie we are highly anticipating. Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. That's the film we'll talk about on next week's episode. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Betty Lavendero. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More info is available at WBEZ.org. For Josh, for Sam, for Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.